Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Thank you for joining us today. I am super excited to host this podcast, primarily because I'm talking to an old friend. David, welcome to The Yield.
It is so good to see you. Thank you.
I think we're going to have a great time in the next half an hour or so. So I want to actually start, David, by maybe just having you give us a little bit of your background and how did you come to meet up where you are today through your journey from Seeking Alpha and some of your previous endeavors. And then maybe we'll get into the book a little bit.
That sounds great. And just interrupt me throughout.
Okay.
So one of the areas of my background, which is fairly uncommon, is actually started my career in human resources. I worked for Kevin Ryan and DoubleClick in human resources back in the late 90s. And DoubleClick was the place to be. It was the internet company, pre-crash, post-crash. And in HR, I was constantly working on things like recruiting top talent and managing and building processes around people and how do you retain great people. And I remember Kevin Ryan said to me at one point, he's like, well, things that you do in HR are very similar to things that I do as a CEO. And I thought, maybe I could be a CEO one day. And not many people go from HR to CEO, but then I went to business school, worked in a series of different companies, won 100 Flowers for 4 or 5 years, et cetera. And then I would say the big break came when I started working for Seeking Alpha. I became president of Seeking Alpha. And Seeking Alpha, for I'm sure you know it and most of your audience knows it, but for those who don't know, it's really a leading publisher focused mostly on small cap stocks to give people an opportunity to learn more about small cap stocks that are under research where there isn't as much information. So I was the president there for a while. And then Barry Diller, IAC, had just acquired Investopedia. And they called up David Jackson, the founder, and they said, we want to acquire Seeking Alpha too. We're going to do a roll-up of all the different publishers, financial publishers out there. They had done a roll-up of acquiring Match and OkCupid and Tinder and all these dating sites. They wanted to do a roll-up of financial publishing sites. So they called up and we said, we're not for sale. They called up again. We're not for sale. Called up again. We're not for sale. Finally, Joey called me up, who's the CEO of IAC, and he said, okay, Seeking Alpha's not for sale. Are you for sale? I'm like, I could be for sale, sure. So then I became the CEO of Investopedia, and I ran the company for about 4.5 years. When I joined, we had 25 employees. It was really just a dictionary. By the time I left, we had about 150 employees. We over tripled the company revenue, and then the company got sold. And then I was out of a job, and I was very happily out of a job, didn't want to start anything. And then WeWork came a knocking and said, would you like to join Meetup? And I said, oh, I love community. I love Meetup. I've been going to Meetups for my entire career and learning things at Meetups. So 27 interviews later, believe it or not, with WeWork and Meetup, because I was the first CEO of Meetup hired on the outside. The founder, Scott Heiferman, had been there for 16 years. And it's a complicated decision when you're the first person brought in after a founder.
Of course.
And it's been close to 4 years of very interesting experiences trying to run Meetup in a pandemic when you can't meet up. So that's the background.
That's great, David. Very, very impressive background. Congratulations. So let's start there. Obviously, you've been in a lot of leadership roles. So what is your philosophy about leadership?
Yeah, I think the number one philosophy is a non-ego-driven philosophy. I deeply believe in servant leadership. And the concept of the upside down organizational chart has always really resonated for me. What I mean by that is, usually when you build an organizational chart, the CEO's on the top, and you know there's the big ego of that person. I believe the CEO's on the bottom. My job is to support each of the people who report into me, each of the executives report into me. My number one job is, how can I make you more successful? Literally, after every one-on-one, I say to someone, Greg, how can I make you more successful? Eileen, how can I make you more successful? If each of the executives are successful and I'm able to support their success, that's what matters. So number one priority is around, not about me, just doing things to enable their success. And then they, each of the vice presidents, do things to enable their manager's success. And a manager's job is to enable the success of every individual contributor. And good things happen if you, not just to those who wait. In fact, usually if you don't wait, better things happen. But that's a big part of my philosophy. And I could share other things as well around trying to transparency.
Let's talk a little bit about radical transparency, because I know that you're a big proponent of it.
Yes. So making smart decisions is obviously something I wrote about in the book and is an obsession of mine. One of the things I have found, Melind, is that oftentimes people make the wrong decision because they don't have access to the same information that someone else has access to. Well, oftentimes there'll be tension in a room, and as a CEO and a founder, you know this, the head of sales might want to do one thing, the head of marketing might want to do another, the head of product might want to do another, but it's because there's asymmetrical access to information that they have. If they all had access to the same information, I'm not going to say that they would, and they took their ego out of it, oftentimes they end up making similar decisions. So number one is, access to information and full transparency leads to better decisions. Number two, to our entire company, we share all of our financials. So there's nothing that we pull back. There is nothing that the board sees that we don't see. Every time there's a board meeting, we share the entire board deck with the entire company. And what the result of that is trust. I once had an opportunity to sit down with Jack Welch, who was the, as you know, but I'm sure most people know, the former CEO of General Electric. When he left General Electric, it was the number one market cap company in the entire world.
Yeah.
In the world. Time magazine gave him the name as the manager of the 20th century. Try 100 years of people being managers, he was the number one manager. So I sat down with him. I said, you were the manager of the 20th century. What is the number one thing you would tell me to do? And he said, it's all about building employee trust. You build employee trust, and the best way to build it is through transparency. And the best thing to do is share everything, share the bad and the ugly, and that's more important than sharing the good. When you make mistakes, when you screw up something, share it, because that sets a culture where other people will be comfortable sharing their mistakes. And we all know when people share mistakes faster, you could fix them faster.
Right.
And you want to address them. What you don't want to have is people afraid to share those mistakes.
So let's dig in a little bit there. So I think obviously it sounds like a very good principle to follow. A lot of us are doing that, right? I mean, just in my own career, what we shared 10 years ago, 15 years ago is very different than what we share today. What do you think that creates in terms of impact for employees that may not be knowing what is a bigger strategic level, initiatives that may be happening, or they may misunderstand some of the information that is thrown at them or feel overwhelmed? So do you think that might have impact on the morale or the culture of the company, because they may not be in a position to actually receive that information and process it?
Oh, such a good question. Okay. So the other principle that needs to be balanced with transparency is decreasing the amount of stress for people on your team.
Yeah.
If you are so radical in your transparency and sharing every single thing that's happening that's bad. So for example, when we were up for sale, we had a buyer, and it would have been terrible, this particular buyer. I couldn't go out and say, guess what? There's gonna be a buyer, and it's gonna be terrible for all of you. Yeah. Most of you are gonna get fired. That would have been what would happen. Can't say that, because right. That would have just been stress that they can't do anything about. And the buyer changed, and the buyer changed again. Buyers basically kept changing over. And people would just feel whipped around the situation, and it would lead to tremendous stress. So it's very important in thinking about what information you're gonna share about two things. Can someone do something with that information that can help them to make a better decision? If so, share it. And is this going to be something that leads to significant stress? And if it's something that leads to stress and it's just a temporary issue, it is better not to share that kind of information, because then it's not being kind and it's not being thoughtful. So you really need to balance the two out. Oftentimes I'll meet with a manager and they're like, you know, they're sharing all these things. And they're like, well, we believe in transparency. So I was just being really transparent, just telling them everything. I was like, whoa, you know, you got to balance transparency with just, you know, thoughtfulness, kindness, et cetera. And it's important to do both.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I agree. And I think that judgment is what executives are paid to do, right? And how do we kind of really exercise that judgment, but at the same time, keep the team motivated? That's really fantastic. So let's get into the book. The book is Decide and Conquer. Decision making is such an important part of not only a CEO's job, but everybody, right? Like in today's world where we are processing information so fast, decision making is crucial. So what motivated you to write this book?
Okay. I had always wanted to write a book. I'm not sure why. Part of it is because I teach at as a professor in a school around entrepreneurship, and a lot of professors also write books. There's an immortality to a book that, you know, my grandkids and great-grandparents were able to see it. So there's that. But it's more, I want to be able to have as much of a positive impact in helping entrepreneurs and helping leaders to the extent that I can, and to learn from as many mistakes. The problem was that I really didn't want to write one of these like boring textbooky books of like the five things for this or whatever. So I needed there to be a crazy story and narrative around it. There's some great books out there like The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz. Yep. Many CEOs have read that, or Delivering Happiness by Tony Hsieh. Just amazing storytelling. So fortunately, being part of WeWork led to a lot of fascinating stories.
Yep.
And that led to the book. And I've always been obsessed with decision making. There was a quote that I read many years ago, and it was by Teddy Roosevelt, and it resonated with me for a long time. The quote was the following: the best decisions are good decisions, the second best decisions are bad decisions, and the worst decisions are no decision. And I've seen so many people, not just in business, but in life, in like their personal lives, have inertia and just be so afraid of making a decision and bias towards the status quo bias, and afraid of change and afraid of doing things, and they're like, they live so many, their happiness levels are just in work and play and in life is just so challenged. It's just so sad that making smarter decisions directly results in like happiness. So that's why I wrote it.
Yeah. No, I'm very excited to get into the book, because decision making is a very, very difficult task for a lot of people. People procrastinate. I think one of the ways that I think about decision making is reversible and irreversible, right? So you can frame the severity of the decision making, because you know, maybe you'll give a little bit more thought if it's irreversible versus if it's reversible, like you can go. And I think we talk a lot about fail fast and things like that, and how do you kind of provide frameworks for people to think through that. So maybe let's talk about this decision-making framework, because that's how, you know, you started the book. So can you tell us a little bit about why that framework is so critical for leaders, and what is that framework?
Okay, first I got to hit on what you said first, because it's so great. So I call reversible and irreversible decisions, I call them trapdoor decisions and non-trapdoor decisions. So there's a trapdoor and you can't get out of it. Like, I decided to have a child. I now had a child. That's a pretty irreversible decision, I hope.
Yeah.
And that's a trapdoor decision. What most people don't realize is many decisions that they think are irreversible are actually pretty reversible. And they look at a decision, oh no, if I invest in this particular product, what's going to be the implication of doing that? What's the implication to my reputation of making this decision? That could be a reversible decision. People tend to think that decisions are more irreversible then they realize, which leads them to have inertia because they're afraid of making decisions that could be irreversible.
Yeah.
So the on this line and the question that you asked around framework, I want to talk a little bit about kind of optionality and the importance of optionality as part of making a decision. What I mean by that is, let's say there's a lot of people that listen to this podcast and that have studied finance. You could study finance and want to become a trader. Or you could study finance and decide you want to become an investment banker. Well, as you will know, someone who becomes a trader, and let's say they're not happy in their job trading, and they look for a new job. The next job that they are best suited for is usually trading. It's harder to move from trading to other types of positions where investment banking, everyone wants to hire someone who has 2, 3, 4 years in investment banking. It opens up analytical skills and all these other opportunities. So some decisions that you make can open up tremendous amount of options for yourself, like being an entrepreneur like you. Other decisions that you make can open up fewer options. And as part of decision making, when you're looking at different things to think about, I don't think often enough people think, well, if I do this action, then what are all the different options that I could have available to myself? Whereas if I do this action, what are many fewer things, what are the trapdoor issues and irreversible options that come out of that? So think about optionality decisions. The reason why it's so important, because a lot of times people have said to me, and I'm sure people have said this to you, and I'm sure it's probably also true for both of us, which is, David, you're so lucky. All these lucky things happen to you. Like I've never, like for Seeking Alpha, I was literally on vacation in Israel. Someone contacted me and said, hey, meet with the founder. And I all have my flip flops and I met with the founder. And someone reached out to me also for the CEO of Investopedia, same thing. So lucky things happen. Lucky things happen because people make decisions where they create lots of options for themselves. And when you have hundreds or thousands of these different options out there in the universe, lucky things can end up happening. So decision making could actually result in end up in lucky things happening to you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you find that for yourself in terms of luck.
100%. I think the way I think about it is, David, really, you basically don't make the goals where you don't take the shots, right? Wayne yes. Gretzky said something yes. similar to that, yes. right? And so the question is that how do you put yourself in that position to actually make a decision and to create that optionality? And you're absolutely right. I think this is a really interesting dynamic to give like reversible, irreversible, or the trapdoor decision making, which is like, hey, which provides you with more optionality? Now, then the question obviously has to also become that optionality should not lead into analysis paralysis. And but I 100% agree with you. If you have optionality and if you are out there taking those shots, then you get those opportunities as well.
Exactly, exactly. You talked about the importance of being speedy just now in making decisions, not analysis mm-hmm. paralysis. And I thought about this a lot of why being speedy is so important. And it comes down to one of my favorite entrepreneurship books, which I'm sure you've read and most listeners have read too, which is The Lean Startup mm-hmm. by Eric Ries. And in The Lean Startup, it talks about how you roll out an MVP approach, minimum viable product, and you kind of keep rolling out approaches from there. The reason to be speedy is because you need to think of yourself as a minimum viable product. You need to get out there. You need to do things and you need to pivot. And you need to iterate and you need to change. And the benefit of being speedy is you get data faster around the decision that you made. And you could determine whether or not it was the right decision or the wrong decision much quicker yeah. versus if you belabor. So another important principle, and you said it, not me, is really the importance of non-analysis paralysis, being speedy, but it all comes down to the ability to learn and get data. You know, they say that the number one priority in a startup is not money, it's not revenue, it's not product market fit necessarily, it's learning. Through learning, you get all those things. And through quick iteration, you get those things. That's why speedy decisions are so critical.
I couldn't agree more. I actually modified the MVP concept, and I actually wrote an article about this and changed it to MEP, which is instead of minimum viable product, it should be the most effective product.
Ah!
And the thesis really was that what happened is over the years, so when Eric Ries wrote his book, right, like the concept made a lot of sense. But what since then, what has happened is technology has changed so dramatically, right? Mm-hmm. And we can do things mm-hmm. much, much faster. Mm-hmm. So what people started doing was interpreting MVP as like, hey, let's get to the market fast and do whatever it takes. And even if the product is crap, I don't care. Like I want to go to the market fast. So what I really like learned and emphasized even here at Yield Studio, you know, especially in our early days, is that how do you kind of build the most effective product? So that obviously has viability into it, but it is also effective in terms of what are the hypotheses that you're testing.
I love it because you're right. The definition of effectiveness is then becomes very important.
Correct.
And if the definition of effectiveness is to understand what your hypothesis is, to test that hypothesis and to learn from that hypothesis, and then to, of course, revise that hypothesis again and test and learn, that's beautiful. Yeah. Okay, I'm gonna steal that from you.
Okay, let's go back here. You know, we started talking a little bit about culture and trust and transparency. Yeah. So one of the decisions here in this book is how do you build good culture? So talk to us a little bit about that.
Sure.
And address the company culture, right?
Yeah.
As it evolves and stuff like that.
Of course.
And maybe, you give anecdotes of good culture and toxic culture. And obviously all of us have been through those journeys in our lives, right? And so how do you think of that?
Oh, wow. Okay, great. So I'll do first the how do you build culture, and then give some very specific examples. And I'd love to hear your examples too. So a lot of companies will have core values, and the core values will sit on a wall and kind of not have any teeth to them. And that's a serious problem, because what core values do is they provide direct and clear insight into what's actually important and rewarded in a company. And too often, what's actually rewarded in a company is different than the core values. So core values talk about integrity and honesty, et cetera, et cetera. But whoever makes the most money is the person who does the most sales. Well, then have revenue be a core value. Like, be honest and upfront about it. So what we do at Meetup, and I advise everyone in terms of culture to do, is to really think through all the ways in which you can embed your core values in every operation within an organization. So for example, when we recruit people, we evaluate every single person that we recruit relative to our 6 core values. When we promote people, we say we're going to review this person on promotion relative to those values. When we do 360-degree feedback or performance management, it's all in the context of those values. We do employee engagement surveys to get feedback about how we're doing. We get feedback relative to those values. We have awards for people who represent those values, embody those values. So I think one is really living the values by embedding it throughout the fabric of the organization is very important. The second thing I'll say about culture is oftentimes people will say, I'm sure you've heard this, of course not at Yale Street or Yodel or any other companies, but they say, man, the culture here just sucks. And you know why they say that? Because culture and leadership are intertwined. They don't want to say the leadership sucks. But the culture of a company is a direct result of who the leader of the company is and who the executive team is within the company. And if they set certain examples of what's important in an organization and what's not important, and I think they're really one and the same. So storytelling or something else? Should I tell a story now?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, here we go. So Investopedia and Meetup were incredibly different cultural challenges when I started each. I could start with Investopedia, and then I could go to Meetup. Investopedia had no culture. What do I mean by that? There are 25 employees in 15 different locations. Very hard, as we talked about, to build culture as a startup, especially when everyone is completely remote. Not impossible, but hard, and harder, 10 years ago, certainly.
Yeah.
They were incredibly accepting of the status quo. There was no ambition to turn Investopedia into really anything more than just a financial dictionary, and as opposed to really the world's largest financial education site with courses and everything else that Investopedia now has today. We brought in a culture there of saying, let's just not look at the narrow definition of what we do today, but how can we expand it? How can we grow it to be much more meaningful? And then focused on transparency and all some other different fun ways in which we could grow Investopedia. Meetup was a very different culture situation. The issue with Meetup was that it was very much ran as a nonprofit organization. It wasn't just nonprofit. The company was losing close to $20 million when I joined. A lot of money for a company that was only doing about $30, $35 million. The focus of the employees was a great one. It was incredibly mission-oriented. How can we make the world a better place? How can we cure the loneliness epidemic? How can we build community for the tens of millions of people out there who desperately need community? But they didn't care about business. They didn't necessarily care about revenue growth. I remember my first day I got in, I said, I love revenue growth! Just
dead silence.
Dead silence. I said, I love community. Yeah, community. And then I would make decisions as a company. And I said, okay, we have this pet project. The only different things that we had to end because people were just all over the place, just not focused on anything that was like really critical to moving the business. And people got very upset. They were very frustrated. Why can't we spend $100,000 on some big holiday party when we're already losing, $20 million, what's the difference? There was just a real lack of an appreciation for like the business aspects of running a company. So I just kept repeating the same adage over and over again, which is revenue gives oxygen to our mission. And understand that the best way to accomplish our mission at Meetup which is a very special mission that means so much, is to be an effective and sustainable business. During the pandemic, there was true risk, and WeWork was talking about it, of shutting Meetup down. And if you are not a sustainable, healthy business, you end up in situations where there's massive layoffs, where there's surprises, and lots of bad things can happen. So my focus was, how do we turn what we have into something that could be a sustainable business? And that was a very different cultural shift.
Super interesting. And I can totally understand that. Culture and corporate values, right? One of the recently, and I would love to take your opinion on this. I just learned this. We don't do this at Yale Street yet. But I was at a conference, and this very old school financial institution, they basically had some of their corporate values aligned with the stakeholders. And, you know, generally what we do as companies is that it's mostly aligned towards like employee and like what type of culture you want to build. And they were very explicit in calling out who their stakeholders are. So their external clients and their stakeholders, meaning the shareholders, a publicly traded company. And then they spoke about community. So community in which they operate. It's a retail bank, so they operate in, you know, probably 70, 80 different communities. So I thought that was a super interesting way to now take it, you know, like really tie it together to kind of create a holistic approach towards what is the culture that you're really building that cares not only about you, but who are your stakeholders and external communities.
Okay, I love what you said. And the reason why I love it is because you want to have that symbiotic relationship between employees, between your clients, between your customers. And that's so important. So when we developed our values, and it mentioned this, I should have though, each of the values is also how we conduct our business. So what do I mean by that? One of the values is invite change. Not accept change, not take change on begrudgingly, but literally invite it on. When we think about what Meetup does in helping people around community, people are oftentimes have anxiety, they're depressed, they're lonely. Invite change in yourself. Come to a Meetup event. Learn about technology that you never learned about. Join an investing club. We have hundreds, not thousands of investing clubs actually on the Meetup platform as well. Invite change in yourself, and that will help you to lead a more joyful, happy life. So, and that's just one example, but there's many different examples that of each of our different core values that kind of represents this symbiotic relationship between both employees and kind of what you do as a business. So thank you for bringing it up.
Yes, of course. I think we are big believers in symbiosis. As our logo indicates, it's an Impala and Oxpecker. So it's about, you know, being a marketplace that's connecting investors to investments. Both parties have to benefit mutually.
Yes.
And only then, you know, it will be successful.
Yeah, and that transparency that you build.
Yep.
Is just so important as a culture for your employees and also, you know, within your business, as you said as well.
Yeah. So let's move on. You basically talk about some of the big challenges impacting people's career goals, right? And again, it goes back to tying to company performance and how the company does. And it can really also make and break the company. So talk to our audience a little bit about how you think about connecting those dots.
Sure. One of the challenges I have found, we've already referenced, but I'll underline it even more, which is just ego. It's harder to be the ultimate leader if ego is what drives all of your decisions. If it's all about building one's own personal brand or doing whatever that person wants to do. And I would say that many of my personal mistakes and failures, and I write about them quite a lot, I give you an example if you want as well, came from personal ambition and the need to have more influence, have more power, rise up in an organization faster. And I see that with some of the people on my team. Sometimes people want to work on a project, for example, that will benefit their career. And that's great for them, but it's not necessarily in the best interest of the company. And it's how do you really sit down with an employee and help them to understand this is really what the company needs. Let's figure out how that could help to grow your skill set. But the number one priority is what's best interest of what the company actually needs right now, not necessarily, you know, what you need right now. So I would say ego is the number one thing to try to figure out. That doesn't mean to just always give and not be able to take credit for things. You want to be able to make sure people know what you do. Very important. So I'm happy to give an example of that, or I'm happy to talk about something else.
No, please.
Okay. So after business school, I decided I had worked in consulting for some time prior to DoubleClick, and I want nothing to do with consulting. So I figured, what's the exact opposite of consulting? The opposite is like retail. It's like getting your fingernails dirty in like brick and mortar stores. It's like opposite of consulting. So I walked around New York City. I'm like, there's a lot of Duane Reade stores here. I'm going to work for Duane Reade after Wharton Business School. Not so common people go from Wharton to Duane Reade. And at Duane Reade, which is a large pharmacy chain, by the way, in New York City, ultimately acquired by Walgreens.
We love Duane Reade.
Good.
Here in New York, right?
We do love Duane Reade in New York, yes. And it's interesting how Walgreens kept the Duane Reade brand, even though they acquired the company about a decade ago.
Yeah.
So, and of course, the reason it's called Duane Reade is because the first store was the corner of Duane
called
and Reade.
Called Duane and Reade.
Exactly, yeah. Downtown. So I was hired to build a new business, to be an intrapreneur, to build a business from the ground up. And it was something called Duane Reade Express, to build a technology to enable people not to go to a pharmacy, wait online, go back again, very inefficient, but instead to be able to go to a pharmacy kiosk machine. And we located them in doctor's offices and hospitals and companies, and touch a screen, connect with a pharmacist 24/7 through video conferencing. And this was back in like 2004, so video conferencing wasn't great. Anyway, started the business and we started building it. And we had 10 machines, 20 machines, 50 machines. And I kind of let my ego get in the way. The technology wasn't there. It kept breaking down. But I wanted to just keep having more people reporting to me, have more of an influence, have more machines. And the technology was not a minimum effective product. It was not an effective product. And ultimately, the CEO was fired. A new CEO came in and said, David, what have you been doing? You're expanding and these machines are falling apart everywhere. This business is getting shut down. And that's what happened. They shut the business down. And it's a perfect example where sometimes you move too fast, it ends up going slowly. And sometimes the right approach to moving fast is kind of slow and incremental to get fast as well. But it's a good example, I think, where ego got really in the way. I ended up leaving the company and then I went to kind of the next opportunity. But unfortunately, I could point to numerous examples of making that mistake.
So how would, if for our listeners who are, listening to us, what guidance would you give them to kind of balance that company goals with their personal ambition and also with their personal strengths? And, is there any framework that you would give them?
Yeah, well, there's something called Ikigai. Have you ever heard of that or no?
No.
It's fine if you haven't. Ikigai is kind of these concentric circles of what are your personal strengths? What are the needs that are out there? And what are the general trends that are happening in the market? And where you want to operate is like at that intersection of the three.
It's like a Venn diagram.
Exactly. It's a Venn diagram of the intersection of the three. And that's where like the best things can happen. Because if it's a growing industry and your personal strengths, et cetera, it's called Ikigai. I don't know how to spell it. So look it up, people.
Yes. So by the way, I totally endorse that. I do that for myself. And I encourage a lot of people who work for me to do that. Which is like, hey, what are you good at? What are you, really passionate about? What does the organization need? And what do you want to do, right? Because it's very important. You may be passionate about something, but you may not want to do that all the time. Or you may be passionate about something, but the company doesn't need that at this time, right? And so like you have to really figure out that intersection to be very happy in your job and to really play to your strengths. Because if you're happy, you will do good work. And I think that is very, very important.
Yeah, well said. I'm thinking right now how we have to revise our performance management goal setting process to be exactly this. We don't do that right now. But I would love for each of our managers to actually sit down with their employees and say, okay, what does the company need? What are your core strengths, et cetera? And that to be the basis of what we're actually focused on as an organization. I've never thought of that, but
yeah,
maybe we'll make some changes.
There you go. So David, let's talk a little bit about Meetup and, obviously pandemic is the favorite topic for everybody. But, in more serious note, obviously a business like yours, which is a social network and was built around getting people together. And pandemic obviously upended that. So tell us a little bit about your experience from those days. And especially the mission being so noble of, reducing people's isolation. How do you see that evolve now that, we are hopefully coming back to normal? I'm so excited that we are doing this podcast live. So tell us a little bit about that.
I was telling Melind that I've done so many podcasts and this is like the first live one that I'm doing. So I'm just so happy to be live. This is great. So for our close to 20-year history, we have been all about IRL, in person. To such an extent that our founder, Scott Heiferman, was at a WeWork summer camp. He took a sledgehammer on stage to a VR device, and he said, "We will never be digital. We will never be digital. We'll only be in person." So then when it's late February, and we start looking at China, because we're in 190 countries, we have 56 million members, 300,000 groups. Start looking at China. China, like 95% of events got canceled. And ours, and we're like, oh, it's going to be another, like, you know, Asian flu or SARS or something. They're not going to come over here.
Right.
We're a big world. And then we started seeing Italy. Wait, why are all the events getting canceled in Italy? What's happening here? Suddenly, of course, I came to New York. And, you know, ironically, even we're all about in person, the number two case of COVID in Mount Sinai Hospital was a Meetup employee. So we were one of the first companies that had that, had the scare in a WeWork building. And that unfortunately made the press, of course. At the time, everything WeWork was making press. And we all had to go home. And I got our team together. And I said, what is our mission? Is our mission IRL, which stands for in real life?
Yeah.
Or is our mission about connections? And the answer was obvious. It's about connections.
Connections, yeah.
And the, we need to build connections the absolute safest way possible. And oh, during the pandemic, people need connections more than any other time. 46% of people prior to the pandemic would say that they regularly feel lonely. 46%, not occasionally, not sometimes. And people who are Gen Zers, people who are in their late teens, early 20s, 62% of Gen Zers regularly feel lonely. I mean, it's terrifyingly scary, and that leads to depression, you know, and other types of things as well, and anxiety, et cetera. So Meetup, in my mind, is the cure for the loneliness epidemic, which is only increasing. So we quickly pivoted. We rolled out an MEP version of Meetup to allow for online events. Because before that, the number one requested feature for an organizer was, could we be an online event? We said no. We turned away tens of millions of dollars from people because they wanted to create online virtual-only events. And we said, no, we're IRL only. So since that time, in 2 years or so, we've had over 6 million online events.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Over 30 million people attending. And it's fascinating experiences. So, for example, people will go for a run like they would normally do, but not necessarily together in the early days when people were didn't know anything. And they'd all come back online and drink a beer together and talk about their run. Or there'd be like an ecstatic dance group that was in Kansas City and only had 5 people that were in Kansas City that were interested in ecstatic dance. But now we made it global, and I was part of some ecstatic dance event, and there were people, 30 people from 20 different countries, all doing like some kind of crazy ecstatic dancing together. So, you know, there's a lot of amazing things that online and global can open up for people. Investing clubs, if you're interested in a very niche area of investing, then what it does is it opens up, many people could be interested in that globally as opposed to just in your city. So online's here to stay. We're currently 75% online. In Texas and Florida, it's like 95% because apparently COVID's not there. And in other places in the country, whether it's in India or Brazil, where there's more challenges, it's a much lower percentage in person. But so far, so good.
Good to hear that. So let's talk as we kind of wind down here. Tell me a couple of favorite parts of the book. What did you like really enjoy writing about, and like which sections were challenging?
Yeah. Probably the most challenging thing for me is that I really didn't want to throw anyone under the bus. And I didn't want the book to be salacious, quote unquote. I wanted to try to be positive as opposed to kind of share a tell-all type thing. And I changed the names of different people. But then there were a couple of people in the book that I just couldn't really change the name for. And I tried to have a balanced approach, but it's something that I personally struggled with and tried to figure out, because the stories were sometimes such powerful learnings that I didn't want to exclude stories, but that was a struggle for me. That was one. The parts of the book that I think I liked the most are where I just laid it out there and talked about major mistakes and failures that I made. You know, the former editor-in-chief, a guy named Caleb Silver of Investopedia, who I hired, I had him read the book beforehand, and he said, you can't publish this book. You can't do it. You'll never like work again. It's you know, you write about things of all these mistakes that you made. You can't do it. And I said, no. I want to talk about these things because that's how people learn. And when you're more vulnerable and you share, it leads other leaders to share those things. So like I'll give two examples of mistakes that I made that are much more detailed in the book. But that was like my favorite part, was sharing those things. It was almost cathartic actually to write about them. So the two were, we had to do a big layoff when I had first joined Meetup because the financials just really weren't working. And after the layoff, there was a tremendous amount of fear. And I made a rookie mistake. Even though I wasn't a rookie, this is my third rodeo of being a president or CEO of a company. And there was so much fear in everyone's eyes that this was the first of what would be many, many different layoffs. And I said something just, I regret to this day, is I said, this is the last layoff. It's not gonna happen. I could have said, I can't promise you, we have no intention to have it, but I said that. Sure enough, not 3 months or 6 months, but a year later, we had to do another layoff. And you know, when you say something, you don't keep to your word.
Goes back to the trust.
It goes back to losing trust. Exactly right. So enormous mistake. And I could go into other mistakes, but I think my favorite part was sharing all those mistakes. And the reason why is because it's so important for people to realize that when they see the CEOs and successful people, our careers are ups and downs, and we've had plenty of problems and mistakes. People don't talk about them enough. They only see those successes by the Elon Musk of the world and the Jeff Bezos of the world. And that leads to people being unhappy and feeling not worthy and not feeling good about themselves. Well, you read a book and you hear about all the mistakes that someone makes, you're like, huh, okay.
He's human.
He's human. And I can potentially rise up. And even if I make mistakes, that's okay. I'll learn from them too. And, you know, I think it's more inspirational that way to hear about mistakes than just to hear about success after success, because that's just fake. It's just not true, as you know
of course.
Very well.
Yeah, outside looking at it is always a rosy picture, but, you know, obviously there's lots of ups and downs, even if you're going towards the right, you know.
Exactly.
So top two takeaways from the book. What should our audience be looking for in the book?
Okay. So the first thing I would say is know yourself and know your decision biases. Some people are biased towards making too bold decisions. And most people are biased to not make decisions enough. Some people are biased to not want to share information. Understand what your bias is and then figure out how to make yourself uncomfortable by taking action that goes outside of your bias. And if you're not uncomfortable in your decisions, and you probably are not making the right decisions. Aim for like a healthy tension in those decisions. That's what I would say, number one. Number two is kind of what we alluded to, the biggest takeaway, which is give a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt to when leaders make decisions. Ask why. Help to understand the context. But too often people might jump to the guilty till proven innocent, or if there's an area that's gray, to think that someone's doing something for the wrong reason. And there's just sometimes things that you can't share in an organization for whatever reason. Bring it up, talk about it, don't be passive aggressive about it, but understand there's some things, a lot of things behind the scenes that were happening. And in Meetup's case, there was a tremendous number of things happening behind the scenes that it would have been not the right thing to be able to share. The last thing I'll share is my yearbook quote from high school, which is, I think, just so important, which I still believe in today. Sometimes in our pursuit of happiness, and a lot of people that listen to this podcast are pursuing happiness and ambitious, it's important to pause and just be happy. And a lot of people just don't take the moment to have gratitude, appreciate how lucky that they actually are, and they're always looking for the next thing. And when they're 80 years old, they're like, I'll finally be happy when I'm 90 years old. No. Find the happiness and find the joy right
now. That is such an important, that's so profound, David. I really appreciate that, because I say this all the time. You can have more, but you can also have less, right? And so I think how do you put that in context is so important for all of us to, whether it's our career, money, family, whatever may be the case that drives you, you know, you really have to contextualize that. Listen, man, I really enjoyed this this conversation. Hopefully our listeners, you enjoyed it. Please check out David's book. It's Decide and Conquer. Decision-making is one of the most important tasks that we do daily. And David, I'm so happy that you wrote this fascinating book. So congratulations on all the success. And thank you for stopping by.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at YieldStreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7-10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at YieldStreet.com.